Vodka o'clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love from AmberUnmasked.com, and you're listening to Vodka O'Clock Podcast. The website and sometimes the show are for adults only, but today is a family-friendly endeavor. So we're kind of back into the swing of things. I didn't even realize that I had already put out 100 episodes like several episodes ago. So we're sort of like post-celebrating 100 here, even though we're like at 100 and something. So I hope you enjoyed all the coverage from the special edition NYC Comic-Con that I delivered to your nerdy little hands a couple weeks ago. And I had recorded several of the panels there. So I hope you guys go and check those out. And today I'm talking stepping aside from comics to delve into a whole new world that I talk about twice a year, and that's the world of gaming. And today's guest is Avanel Wing. Avi is one of the organizers of DexCon, which is one of the massive gaming cons held in beautiful Morristown, New Jersey. So, Avi, welcome aboard.
It's a pleasure to be here, Amber. Thank you for having me.
So this is the 17th year of DexCon, am I right?
This is the 17th DexCon. We took a break between DexCon 6 and DexCon 7, so we've actually been doing this for 25 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because it's like when I realized that on the the website it said DexCon 17, I was like, that is quite a legacy to have under your belt.
I'm really proud of the fact that I've actually personally been involved now with 17 DexCons.
So when I've only been going to the show, like I go to the DexCon and to Dreamation, and I know that Double Exposure runs like a bunch of other things too. So my experience is I get to the beautiful Hyatt Hotel in Morristown, and it seems to literally take up the entire hotel in the most casual way possible. It's you can see people that aren't con goers that still, you know, can just saddle up to the bar and whatever. I mean, it's a beautiful hotel, and it's a really great little town, by the way. If anybody's like not been there, it's there's plenty of pedestrian stuff to do, just walking around the square and going to all the eateries and everything like that. So, did you start at the Hyatt? Have you been there this long, or was it an evolution to get there?
It was definitely an evolution to get there. We have moved hotels several times. As we expand, we outgrow hotels. Sometimes hotels outgrow us if they end up with a significant enough chunk of business that is more corporate. They will decide that we just aren't their audience anymore. And that's kind of what happened before we came to this hotel. Our last hotel was deciding that we just weren't the market that they were focused on anymore. And while we were having changing hotels is the pits, because you have to convince everybody that the costumes aren't scary and the fake swords aren't scary. And yes, that's a dude in gold lame hot pants. It's okay. He's okay. Once we were sort of in the middle of this, oh no, we're going to have to find a new hotel, the Hyatt actually reached out to us. And they were like, no, it's fine. Come talk to us. And we're like, I don't know. Are you sure you understand what you're getting into? And our community is a really well-behaved, very considerate, very community-minded group. But there's always a little bit of anxiety. And the Hyatt just took it all in stride and understood exactly what we were looking for, and their staff just loves having us there, and it's so nice to be there.
Yeah, my experience has always been so pleasant. The staff's always really kind, you know, really friendly, and the volunteers of the show are just amazing as well. I forget, like, I was lost looking for a room and, you know, got like a personal escort up to the room, not just like when I'm at New York Comic Con and a volunteer who's not really sure of something points and says, oh, go that way. You know, like I was taken to where I needed to be. It was, you know, it's entirely different, you know, on a scale, but it's always been a really good show for me. Yeah. And I know that, because because gaming itself has different genres within it. Like you have your superheroes, you have your fantasy and sci-fi, and you've got your steampunk, and you've got your horror people. So there's like all these different people all coming together. And I know that the steampunk conventions have had some hotel issues as well, you know, because they have like special circumstances. Like, they need to be able to be outside and have fire. I mean, you know, like, and I haven't seen that. I haven't seen anything quite that elaborate at DexCon or Dreamation, but I have enjoyed, like, the LARP is my favorite thing there. And, you know, you could just be hanging out in the lobby when a horde of zombies comes your way. So, yep. So let's talk about some of the things that I don't know about. I saw that the schedule is really filled with Pathfinder Society and Greyhawk Reborn. So what can you tell me about these things?
You know, honestly, I will admit that the Greyhawk Reborn is something that is outside of my specific sphere of information. We have a coordinator that handles that, and so because there are 1,000-plus events, I let someone else know what's happening with Greyhawk.
Yeah, no, that's what I was wondering. I'm like, how can they know all about this? Like, I know specifically about LARPing. Like, I can sit through, like, a D&D session and kind of know what's going on, but I'm more of an observer of gaming. And, you know, I mean, the schedule that you have is incredible. And for anybody that's listening, if you get to the show and you go down this one hallway, it has printouts, and you've never seen anything like it. I mean, if people like analysis and spreadsheets, this is, you know, where you need to go. It is wallpapered with spreadsheets of the schedule, and everything is coded because it's like 24 hours of gaming. There is at any time something that you will want to do. So I don't know anything about Pathfinder and Greyhawk Reborn either. So I just know that there's a ton of it.
So the reason we are able to do this, we are up to 4 conventions a year. We've got DexCon, which is our flagship convention. We have Dreamation, which is fundamentally the little sister of DexCon. We have 2 other conventions that have completely different focuses. Plus, we run a playtesting hall at Gen Con. So you can imagine that a lot of our lives go into the organizing and the coordination. So there's no way for Vinny and I, our chairman Tiny, our director of operations, or our vice chairman, to know all of the pieces that go, or the minutia of all the pieces that go into, for example, a Greyhawk Reborn campaign. And so we have an entire army of volunteers behind us who have their pulse on board gaming, and what's coming out of Essen, and what was hot at BGGCon, and we have people who, you know, we've got something like 22, I think, different groups that are people who are responsible for running LARPs, and so they know, they're exploring the edges of the genre, they are on the cutting edge of what's happening in LARP right now. We have the Indie Game Explosion, where there are people who are independent game designers who are bringing their stuff, who are publishing things. And so we have coordinators who stay on top of being aware of what's happening and bringing us things so that we aren't trying to be in every place all the time.
Right. I love talking to those indie game creators because they, yes, they are there to sell. I mean, they're there to sell their idea and their product, but some of them are there for testing.
Right.
So you can go up, and they usually give, like, I wouldn't say it's more than, like, 45 minutes of gameplay, but enough to introduce people to the environment, to the characters, and see how well things play out. And if need be, they'll take your changes. They'll take your suggestions and take it back and maybe come back next year and, you know, try to implement things in a new revision. So I think that's, like, an incredibly interesting opportunity for people who like the like, back-end development side of games. Like, you can go and not only play, but you're sort of a contributor in that way, that you're giving live feedback. And, you know, that's not something that you can do if you go to a monstrous event to check out the latest thing that Sony has. Like, by the time you're in beta for Sony, there's not a whole lot of feedback you're going to be able to give.
We really pride ourselves on being a launching pad for people that have a great idea and just need sort of a nudge in the right direction to find their footing in the industry and to make the right connections to make their game a reality. And we really enjoy seeing what's the brand new and what people are working on. We actually have so many small companies that have asked us for demo tables to interact directly with their audience at DexCon, that we had to completely rearrange how we're setting up the front lobby to make sure that everybody who wants exposure gets the exposure they want.
That's really cool. And it's a really good compliment to when you have, like, the big stars of gaming come out. Like, I'm not sure if it was DexCon or which event it was, but, like, you had, like, John Kovalik from Munchkin, right?
Steve Jackson out last year.
Steve Jackson, okay. I mean, these are, you know, these are names that you see on the packaging.
Right.
So it's like every single level, there's somebody there for you to talk to and ask if you are interested in building your own game, how you would start that and the process of it. And people want to talk. They want to answer your questions.
Absolutely. Metatopia, our fall event, is the one that is more specifically targeted towards people who want to become game designers. It's more of a industry show and a professional development convention. But DexCon really is the event where you get to sit down at the gaming tables and play with these people. And they show up and they're players like you and they want to participate in, you know, the Fate games, or they sit down and play Midnight Fiasco, and you get to sit down at the table with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you always wanted to break out your own cloak and sword to do that, you can do that. it's a pretty cool thing. Although remarkable, by the time that I get there, people are starting to get really tired because I get there after work. And I see a lot of people that are in pajamas. And they're gaming. I'm like, well, you don't get more comfortable and casual than this show. Because you can be in your corset for a few hours, and at some point you want to take your corset off.
Right. And people are just as happy to see you at the gaming table when you show up in your PJs. They're like, okay, and now we're going to sit down and play this.
Yeah, it's really cool. And like I said about, you know, that it's family-friendly, is there's the kids, you can tell they sort of end up having their own little community and knowing each other, and plus some people attend as bigger groups, like the LARPers. They know that it's been historically a really safe environment. So
we work really hard on that, and our security department takes it very seriously. And if somebody is being a problem, we usually are aware of it before it turns into a bigger issue. We work very hard on making sure that we know who the parents are that have kids with them. We actually this year are trying something a little new, and some of our events are marked specifically as encouraging kids and welcoming kids. And there's some kids teaching kids to board game events that I'm really excited about. Clark and Amanda Valentine have really worked with me to spearhead making sure that not only are there games where kids are welcome, but there are games where kids are encouraged to participate.
That's really great to hear that that's a new introduction this year, because I think it's important. I know that at some of the comic shops, they'll take that step as well. They'll say, okay, well, it's game day, but we want the kids to know that it's maybe, you know, it's sort of like the competition might feel a little too stressful if they're with people even just a few years too old for them to be playing with. They need to feel like the anxiety is not there and that it's okay for them to just chill and be a kid.
Right. Well, and there's a difference between playing a game with a kid where you have to understand that they're going to pop up out of the chair and walk around the table twice before they're ready to take their turn.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if I have a hard time sitting still for a 3-hour board game, you're not going to have a 7-year-old that can sit there for and be focused on it at the same level, but they do participate, and I want them to feel like there's a space where they can engage in the community and be part of what we're doing in a way that is age appropriate.
Right. And at the same time, because this is such a big show for 24 hours that goes on and on, there's plenty of adult stuff to do.
Absolutely. We also made sure that the kids' stuff was timed in such a way that there's time for people to have breakfast, there's time for lunch, and then in the evenings it's, you know, more adult-focused scheduling so that we, you know, we're assuming that kids are going to bed at a certain point and we don't need to be as aware of scheduling for them during those hours.
Right. And I don't know, have you ever thought or gotten the feeling that kids are afraid of any of the costumes or anything like that?
No, never.
They're okay with it? Okay.
I've had shy kids, but okay. Our community is so receptive to kids in the space that if we were to ever have an instance, the likelihood that the person in the costume would take off their hat and get down on kid level and be like, no, I'm just a dude in a costume, is incredibly high. And I can't imagine that it would be an uncomfortable situation for very long, because our community polices itself and is like, oh, there's a scared kid. Let them know that it's just like someone on TV. I'm just wearing a costume.
Okay. Because I know that, because I help organize events too. And one of the things that we have to stipulate is that, it wasn't like our own thing. It like came from parents who are customers of the store, was that they didn't want scary costumes around. And, you know, if you're doing an event in October, that's kind of sometimes really hard to ask.
Yeah, we've never run into that. But the event that we have in late October, early November, is the industry event. So we've never run into that with a convention. But I can see where that's a hard thing to work around.
I'm sorry, I got a little bit of feedback. Is there LARPing for kids, or is that something that kids do, or do they just like wear costumes once in a while and run around?
Some of the LARPs are kid-friendly. If someone is interested in finding kid-friendly LARPs, you just go to the website, and there's a link for the schedule and a link to LARPing. And you look for things that say all ages and beginners welcome. Those are kind of the two current keywords that indicate that kids are welcome. And some of our GMs are really good at getting kids involved. There's a Homestuck LARP, which is targeted at the teen-tween sort of age range. And it's actually being run by a 14-year-old who's working diligently as we speak to finish up her character sheets for a 30-person LARP.
That is huge. I see those characters at every convention.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about it. I just know that, like, my best friend's daughter is, like, super into it, too. He's like, you know, he has to know what it is. He's like, I can't believe that I know this. I'm like, of course you know this. You have a teenage daughter.
I keep trying, and what I end up saying to my niece is, I think I'm just too old for this.
And then, you know, more along the lines of things that I do know about is the burlesque show.
Right.
I know this at least is the first time that I've heard of the D20 burlesque coming to any place that I could drive to. So I was like really excited to see that on the schedule. I know it's July 4th at midnight. Was there any concern about scheduling because of a holiday?
We did have a conversation about it. They were a little concerned, and you know, obviously there's a lot of things happening in New York City on the holiday weekend, but we are having an interesting effect, and it's something that we've seen time and again, that our attendance actually gets a bump from happening on the holiday weekend. And so we talked about it, and next year we're also on the holiday weekend, and we'd made the decision that if it didn't go well this year, we were going to move them to Thursday or Saturday next year, or I guess Thursday, whichever ends up being off the 4th of July. But once we started getting registrations, we saw that there wasn't really a concern because they're not seeing any dip in numbers at all.
Does Morristown have, do you know if the town itself is having any festivities? Because it's a pretty historic town for New Jersey.
They always have something going on. They take their colonial history very seriously.
Very, very seriously. So I figured that there was a good shot that if, you know, people were running around as paladins and zombies, that they might be seeing George Washington run through the park as well.
I keep trying to find, like, the core reenactor group in Morristown to pull them in.
I think it'd be great.
Yeah. No luck so far, but we're working on it. If you're listening and you're part of that reenactment corps, come see me.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, I heard that Ben Franklin was wandering through Wizard World, so
that's awesome.
You know, if Philadelphia can have a Ben Franklin, I think, you know, our double exposure gamers would love to see a George Washington. So let's see. There's lots of LARP. There's burlesque. So yeah, again, I'm like really excited to see the burlesque. And one of the things that caught my eye, and hopefully you can explain better what this is, was there's all these challenges on the schedule, and one of them was called the $5,000 Interactive Puzzle Challenge, and it sounds incredibly tense. Like you get locked in a room and you have to figure something out just based on evidence that you're given.
This is going to be the third year that Vinny runs the Interactive Puzzle Challenge, and it is really intense. You show up at 8:30 in the morning. At 9 a.m., the doors to the room lock. No one leaves. No one enters. You don't get any cell phones. You don't get to keep your watch. There's a clock on the wall that counts down the time. And if you as a community solve the puzzle within the first hour, it's a $5,000 prize. Each hour after that, the prize money ticks down. So at 10 o'clock, between the 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock hour, if the puzzle is solved, it's $4,000. And there's a mechanism built into the challenge to determine how the prize money is split. And it is absolutely intense. It integrates all sorts of different puzzle components. Have you seen the advertisements or participated in the locked in a room thing that's hot in New York City right now?
No, I haven't seen them.
Oh, there's a company that literally uses, like, they found a way to monetize their office space after hours, and they have these puzzles that lead you to a clue, that lead you to a key, that gets you out of the room. And you go and you pay them, like, $20 to participate in this thing. You get a team of, like, 5 or 8 people together. And it's very similar to that, except that it is a series, it is more than one puzzle that all interconnect to give you an answer. And I'm interested to see, because last year's competitors did better and came closer to solving the puzzle than the year before. And so I'm thinking this year might be the year that someone gets it.
Do you think that people most easily decide to attack the puzzle as a group versus any loners that just say, no, I'm going to solve this mystery on my own?
There is no circumstances that I can imagine a loner winning. The first year we ended up with a room full of loners, and they all sort of milled around each other and worked at cross purposes. And I wandered in and out a couple of times through the back door and was like, wow, they are all like off chasing different things. And I don't know that they're ever going to get two pieces put together at the same time. And that's actually why I think last year's group came closer, is that they split up into factions and were actively divvying out tasks and working on things together. And so maybe this year's group will realize that they can't do it as loners and they need to coordinate.
It sounds like the best structure to handle that. Survivor reality show type of situation, but you're doing it based on a mystery.
Yeah.
And you don't know what the puzzle even is that you're solving. I mean, when you go to those, real live action mystery dinner things, you see it before you. You see somebody get murdered or there's a body somewhere, whatever the thing is. But in this case, is it just that you're just getting these objects?
Yeah, so the puzzles follow known puzzle construction principles. So if you've ever done a cryptogram, you might recognize certain components and be like, oh, I understand what this is. Vinny has actually spent years studying the art of puzzling and of those types of brain-bending challenges. And so he pulls all of his experience and all of his knowledge together into one room. And so there may be a number of puzzles sitting next to an object puzzle where you have to figure out how the objects fit together. And I will tell you, there is a mountain of props that is probably 6 foot tall and 6 foot across in my living room right now for this puzzle challenge.
That sounds so intriguing.
Yeah.
I think I would fail spectacularly. Like, I'd be the person, like, clawing at the door, you know, like, I can't do it. I just can't.
We get a bunch of people that are really intense about it, and it's fun to watch them start to unfold it.
That's good. Well, you know, I think when people like gaming, I think it's sort of like a different mindset. They like to enjoy working towards something, not just the answer.
Right, right.
And that's, you know, that's what certainly what the RPGs are all about.
Yes.
You know, you might be after the ancient talisman of, you know, Tibet or something that in a pyramid, but the gate, that's not what it's about. Like, it's about getting there.
Right.
Now I know that the previous layouts you had like the game developers in the front lobby, and you were saying that you restructured that a little bit, and then the LARP meetups were in all different places, and then the lower level had the miniatures.
Yes.
And I didn't know that there was any actual gameplay going on there, if it was just people who like those sorts of things just kind of hanging out and chatting. That's what it looked like when I would go down there. And it was spectacular. I mean, you feel like Godzilla when you walk down there.
So there actually is gameplay. We have tabletop wargaming, and then we've got Double Exposure's arena, which is a giant felt battleground that we put different types of combat using different wargaming systems on. One of the events that's happening this year is there's actually a Star Trek air battle that is happening, and we've collected miniatures. We've made some of the ships that we couldn't get to the right scale. And all of that is in the wargaming schedule. I'm going to pop open the arena schedule. It's going to make a little bit of noise. Sorry. So any of our arena battles are big scale things that are just a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of love goes into crafting those events. I find it bogglesome because I will go down there at 9 in the morning and people will be playing in the first slot. And I will go down at 6 at night, and they are still there playing, and they are just so focused. And, you know, their armies are painted with such joy and such care. And it really is this intensely focused style of gaming.
I noticed that, too, because it's, again, it's not always about winning anything. It's that there's so much care and attention that goes into whether it's something that they can construct by hand or if it's the little pewter things that they're painting. And then they, you know, gathering all the environment, you know, like the different grass and trees and vehicles and stuff like that. It's the sort of the people who like models obviously are going to like miniatures, but then miniatures serves this other purpose as well for more than display if you want to do more.
Right.
And there's, you know, and then there's this gameplay aspect of it. So since I'm used to seeing the games where, like you said, you had like the green layout for grassy looking stuff and mountains and everything. So if you're doing a Star Trek thing, are you developing some sort of battleground for that would look like a planet landscape or just like a black space type of thing?
I think that for this year, they're just accepting that the arena is green and because they've been focused on building the models. But there was definitely some intense conversation in my living room about how to convert the arena into a starfield.
Okay, because that would be pretty cool. But on the one hand, when I think about seeing spaceships against green, it really makes me think about movie making.
Right.
So if I were to see that, it wouldn't jar me at all. I would just be like, oh, you know, it's, you know, so that you can take a picture of it and then remove the green. Right. Now, so for our last little bit here, one of the things I was wondering is, since you're the organizer, I wanted to ask specific questions that I think only somebody who's a staff member might be able to answer. Do you know, like, how many attendees that you get?
We have seen a significant increase over the last... So moving into the Hyatt Morristown has been really good for us. The combination of being connected to the community and the fact that all of the food that's within walking distance, the fact that the hotel works with us so hard to keep rooms affordable, the fact that the space is affordable and we have not needed to increase our badge prices significantly over the last 10 years has been a really big deal. And so we are expecting about 1,500 people this year.
Okay. Now, in your registration process, because I know other conventions do this for basically for their own analytical reasons, do you have any way to determine the demographics by gender or by age?
We don't. So, one, I don't tend to collect the information if I'm not going to use it. And in the past, we haven't seen a lot of value to it. We're getting a lot more of that question from potential sponsors, so we might in the future. So a lot of our demographic information is sort of more just because we know the community very well and we keep an eye on who's showing up and who isn't. Is there a specific demographic question that you have?
Well, I was specifically curious about the, you know, gender ratios, and the ages seem to be, I don't know, it always seems to be people like 30s and older, and then like kids running around. So, and they're not like unsupervised running around. Like, this is the one place where I've never had to deal with like pesky kids. I'll say that. But the male to female to other ratio is something that I've just started learning about, taking notice of, because I've been sitting through some panels about, you know, transgender creators and transgender cosplayers, and so I just gender keeps popping up these days.
So we are acutely aware of the fact that there are a bunch of conventions out there that do a truly terrible job of creating safe and inclusive space. And so we work really hard to make sure, for example, in the conference center, which is part of the hotel space that we use, I actually make the bathrooms unisex. And we put up a sign that basically says, we don't care where you pee, we like you anyway, please pick the facility that makes you most comfortable. And if you have cis privilege, we suggest that you switch it up and use the other bathroom occasionally. And I deliberately cover up the gendered signs. The first time I did this, I went exploding around the corner, ran into the bathroom and stopped dead and went, oh, that's a urinal. Huh. And then went on with my business. And so I understand that for some people, it's a little, startling. For me, the first time I ran into the bathroom and went, oh, a urinal. I was like, I'm in the wrong room. Wait, no, I did this. This was my idea. We don't collect that sort of demographic information, and I don't think that demographic information is necessarily always valid because people's self-definitions shift. And certainly we give space for people to explore identity that they might not be able to explore in their real life and to try things on and see if it actually fits. We don't put up with harassment. We don't put up with people being mouthy at somebody that really doesn't need it and doesn't need the aggression or the microaggression. And we work really hard to educate people. So if I walk through and I hear someone say, oh, that's so gay, or using other derogatory terms, I'll pull them to the side and be like, okay, here's why that's problematic. Could we avoid it? So I don't have specific demographic information, but rather than like, I've been spending my energy on the practical solutions and making sure that people know and doing outreach, saying, hey, I saw on G+ that you said that you're really anxious about gaming conventions because of your gender identity. Why don't you come and work with us? and we will build a wall around you, and then you can wander out at your own speed, at your own pace, at your own comfort, and become part of the community in a way that you can control. So as you get more comfortable, you can venture further from the registration desk or con suite or staff suite.
That's like the most remarkable thing that's been happening this year. And it's usually the smaller shows that are willing to do that. And I think that's just, it's so gracious and it's human. It's just so human.
It breaks my heart to imagine somebody staying at home, wishing that they could be at a convention and staying away because of something that they have no control over and they didn't choose. And if I can fix that for them, I'll give them the badge and I'll put them behind the registration table and I'll introduce them to a bunch of people who accept today's gender presentation and accept who they are today and want them to be part of what we're doing. And it makes me so proud of our community that when someone shows up and I say, look, you know, I'm bringing in someone that's got a little bit of anxiety, they're like, oh, we got this. We've done this. No sweat.
It seems like there's no better place for people, like you said, to sort of try to feel freer in being themselves than at something that embraces role-playing. Because, you know, I'm not a, you know, level 14 paladin or mage or whatever either. And, you know, if I'm going to try to blend in into a world that's protected, like you said, you're in these walls.
Right.
People are not going to make fun of you for whatever your thing is.
And it's time, and it's a space outside of time. It has no impact on your daily life. I find especially campaign play LARPs really interesting to watch. I've seen it happen in my own campaign where we've had kids come in and they get to try different things. And I've seen actual experimentation. I'm going to play this villain and I'm going to be this raging asshole and I'm just going to be awful and manipulative and insulting and I'm going to see how the world treats me. And it's not always conscious, or it'll be, you know, this time I'm going to roll up this character that's a real sweetheart. And they actually play with how it feels to have the world respond to them on these giant, exaggerated macro levels. And then they get to put it away and go out to dinner with their friends at the diner, and it's done. But they've had that experience of being the villain or being the outsider or being the leader. And I've watched over the years, I've had the luxury and the privilege of watching kids really sort of refine their sense of self based on these experiences at role-playing tables and in LARPs, where they've gotten to see how people respond and adjust accordingly. And it's really profound.
It is. And it's not, you know, and it's not even a thing for awkward, you know, teenagers or something like that. Like I went and sat through one of the supervillain LARP.
Right.
And I'm somebody who's really comfortable speaking when I know what I'm supposed to be saying.
Right.
So I never had theater training. I painted the sets and built stuff for theater. I didn't act ever, and I never did improv. So I was there just trying to cover the session from a press perspective, and they're like, no, sit. I'm like, oh my God, what do you mean? And so I sat, and they pulled me in, and it took a real while for me to just say, okay, well, this is my character, and I'm, you know, this bitchy, self-important, you know, supervillain, and it was a strange experience, you know, and yet really, really useful, because I don't go to board meetings and have to stand up in front of people. That's not what I do, but I can, you know, but I can grab a microphone and talk about something that I'm comfortable with, like comic books or something, you know. It's the sort of thing where there are skill sets that I think we need in life that we're not necessarily taught.
I played in Lizzie Stark brought Mad About the Boy over from Nordic LARP and ran it October 2 years ago. And I am still talking about the ways that game changed me and the things that game taught me about myself. And at the point that I played, I'd been LARPing for 20 years. And I came out of that game shaken to my core, and it was absolutely transformative because it challenged my sense of self. And it was an all-women game. There were only a few men on staff, but the entire campsite, for the most part, was 45 women and 3 or 4 men that were doing support positions like cooking. And the experience was so challenging to my paradigm that I'm actually a better organizer and a more compassionate community leader because I've had that experience and because the game was so intense for me.
I'm going to write that down because I had never heard of that one before.
It was amazing. There's a lot of material because it was the first Nordic LARP, which is a specific style of LARP that started, obviously, in Nordic countries. And it's less mechanics-based and more storytelling and character-based, and it explores themes. And there's like, an entire study of what Nordic LARP is available on the internet. But it was the first run of a major Nordic LARP on U.S. soil. And so there's a lot of information on the internet about our specific run of the game.
That brings up another question, since we're talking about gender diversity. It's because we're in Morristown, not the most diverse city in that you can think of. Have you gotten any feedback about other, like, ethnic diversity incorporation?
We've worked very hard to give gamers that are gamers of color or gamers from diverse backgrounds space to talk about their experiences. Our fourth convention, Maelstrom, actually went out of its way to talk about social justice and to put social justice front and center in the conversation. So, you know, there is this conversation and this is this awareness that historically and traditionally many aspects of gaming thought of themselves as relatively affluent white men who had the financial ability to buy gaming materials. And that's sort of the impression that many people have of the industry. That's never been my experience of the industry from a first-person perspective. If I step back and look at it from a broader perspective, I can see the trends and the patterns. Double Exposure's events, one, because we're so LARP heavy and LARP pulls in people from all sorts of areas and really fascinates people. We get a younger crowd and the younger groups of gamers, in my experience, have sort of a nonchalance about diversity. And that is really encouraging to me. That's entirely anecdotal. But we also work on reaching out to communities and programs that serve underprivileged populations and make sure that they know, you know, there's a library program that comes out to us and they bring a bunch of kids that are gamers of color and they've jumped in and they've been with us for years and they're now bringing a younger batch of kids in. So, again, in addition to acknowledging that it is a less diverse hobby than would be representative of the people we live and work with every day, we're working on changing it and making sure that if someone walks in, they aren't like, oh, I'm the only black chick in the room. That's not comfortable or cool. We're making sure that there's representation across the board and that people feel comfortable talking about their experiences as the other at the table so that people who perhaps have privilege and exercise privilege realize that they have the capacity to share their privilege with other people and to make the table inclusive and comfortable and to avoid microaggressions and avoid falling into using tropes and stereotypes in their games. And so we're working really hard to have that conversation as often as we can in as productive a fashion as possible.
That's really great to hear because these are things that I, you know, as just a white person from suburbia that I never would have necessarily thought of on my own. Like I never would have said, you know, what in this picture doesn't belong, you know, like it was just where I grew up. I mean, this is, you know, I live out in the country and it's, you know, filled with white people. You know, it's just the way it is. Thinking, you know, I had first started exploring the feminism issues with the entertainment industry. And obviously, you know, you come across channels like Feminist Frequency.
Right.
And the just hearing of the stories that goes into the video game aspect of gaming and how badly some women can be treated, not just as gamers, but as game developers. And it's really appalling and shocking sometimes that now we're just like, oh yeah, that's how it is, you know?
Right.
And you suddenly lose the shock where it's like just another day. And comics has its own set of problems. And then people start talking about racial diversity and lack of sensitivity and lack of inclusion. And it was one of my friends who pointed out to me something that, again, I would not have noticed on my own, but watching, like, The Lord of the Rings and someone saying there's not, like, a single actor of color in there. And somebody said something about you can't have a brown hobbit. And I'm like, that is really the most bizarre thing that I've never noticed and is so true. Like, why is this stuff not done?
Right. And because the conversations are happening, there are actually people who are saying if a piece of game art is deliberately, consciously not sensitive to a feminist or an inclusive mindset, I'm simply not going to buy it. And so there's this momentum building where I really think in the next 5 years, we're going to see a significant shift in representation in game art, in the makeup of gaming companies. There are a lot of smaller publishers who are going out of their way to recruit people that are not part of the standard stable of content providers, right? And there's a lot of conversation about what contributes to people either feeling included or feeling like they can't. I'm having a conversation by email with somebody about the fact that there's this impression in the industry that because there is a gender divide in how, or there's, I can identify a difference between my female gaming friends and my male gaming friends about how we approach role-playing systems. And there's this impression that women write fluff and men write mechanics, and therefore women are just storytellers and they're writing fiction, they're not game designers. And I feel like there's a lot being done to challenge those impressions and those assumptions and to look at designing games in a way that takes them away from the big ponderous tomes and who says, okay, well, maybe you don't understand all of the math involved in board game design, but you've got this really cool concept. So let's connect you with a mentor who actually can help you with the math. And yes, you're still a game designer. The fact that you don't understand probability or probability makes your eyes cross, it doesn't prohibit you from being a game designer. And so I feel like a lot of those boundaries are coming apart because people are willfully taking them apart. Of course, there's still going to be things like access to the internet and access to events and the time to invest in these design concepts. But in general, I feel like the hobby is opening up. And I think that when we look back in 5 or 10 years, we're going to feel like last year was the dark ages.
Do you think that the change that's coming, because it's, you sort of, like you said, you feel it coming. Do you feel like the change that's coming for the newer generation will be because fundamental education is different and allowing and encouraging young girls to explore the STEM programs that, you know, was always sort of not encouraged? Even if it was passively not encouraged, it was, you know, I mean, gone are the days where they just stick girls in home ec. I mean, that's what my mom went through.
Right.
You know.
Yes.
But
I think that, so a friend of mine tells a story about the fact that at some point her mom said to her, or you could become a doctor. And she stopped dead in her tracks and she turned and she stared at her mother and she went, or I could be a doctor. Huh. And someone had to actually say to her that that option was open because her pediatrician was male, her eye doctor was male, her dentist was male. And so it had never occurred to her that being a doctor is something a girl could do. And so, you know, in time, as we keep having this conversation and we say no, you really can be a game designer. Let's talk about what the barriers are. Let's talk about what it is you need to overcome. Let's talk about what the definition of a game is. Are you designing micro games? Are you playing around on Twine? That's kind of a game. And so as the conversations happen and there's more you could being thrown around, I think more people will consider it and explore it and claim it as part of their identity.
It's definitely something that, just because it was never my thing, that I almost felt like, you know, we were part of the first level. You know, I'm over 40, and I feel like we were at the first level where they were I don't know, maybe it was just my guidance counselor. My guidance counselor was a woman, right. And I wanted to take auto shop. And instead, she wouldn't let me take auto shop, but she stuck me in honors physics.
Oh,
so, okay, my physics class, great, was, you know, maybe 50-50, boys to girls. But I didn't care. I was just like, okay, this is kind of cool. We're learning about how things collide. Okay, this is cool. I had a good teacher. It was fun. But I can't say I clicked with it. I mean, I can't say it was my thing that I ever wanted to further do. And a part of me wishes that I had, that I wish I had more interest, because if I could be one of those people that, you know, like takes apart a crime scene, that would be like the coolest job ever.
Right.
But but I'd rather write about the person who takes apart the crime scene. I'd rather create a character that's gonna do this instead of being the character.
So one of the like tenets of social sciences is that you can't really analyze an era or a movement while you're in the middle of it, because there's too much moving and it's hard to see what the influences are until you've got, you know, a decade to step back and look at it and the space of objectivity. And so I think that predicting where things are going is going to be really hard, because there's all this conversation, but I don't really know how it's going to fall out, because if we had talked during the 70s about what was coming for women, the idea that in 2014 you and I would be discussing the fact that women were still being discouraged from careers in STEM would be stupefying, because women really thought that we were on the brink of stepping into gender parity and into being treated as equals and being able to make our own choices. And the study of the feminist backlash that happened in the late 70s and early 80s is really interesting, because if you look at where we were going, where we ended up doesn't match. And so I am really hopeful that we finally get to what our parents were expecting when we were born, what our parents expected when we went into kindergarten, because that isn't what we got. You know, that's not where we ended up. And the fact that, over the last 5 years or so, I've been picking apart my own experience in the gaming industry and realizing that gender has had an impact, and that my perception of myself because of my gender and because of socialized norms means that I accepted people talking over me and beating me up with a rules book metaphorically, instead of standing my ground and saying, okay, that may be the type of game that you want to play, but I'm going to go over here and play a game where the book is less important than the human components of the game. And so I'm really hopeful that we really do get there. I am hesitant to make predictions. I know that things are changing. I hope they end up in a place where, you know, we end up with women physicists who are working on the Hadron Particle Collider, who come and run board games about particle colliding. You know, I really hope that's where we are in 10 years.
That'd be cool. It's, you know, I was just doing a bunch of research on Amelia Earhart, and, you know, seeing these women in history that we just aren't really discussed. I mean, there were a significant number of female pilots that, you know, and you've heard of one.
Right. I grew up on Air Force bases, and I, other than Amelia Earhart, I could name you exactly zero female pilots. That's just devastating.
Yeah. And I imagine that the worlds of science are exactly the same way, because it was the way the processes were. Like, the process was against you, that you couldn't even submit a paper without a man's name being on it.
Right.
So, you know, people just, you know, these women of history that we owe things to, we don't even know that we owe them respect and gratitude.
So I'm going to do a shout out to Lillian Cohen Moore. And
I love her.
Okay. So her oral history project, Makers, Schemers, and Dreamers, is an oral history project about women in the gaming industry. And she is working on bringing those stories forward and making sure that the contribution of women who perceive themselves, because they ended up in administrative roles or support roles, perceive themselves, or even, you know, they started out as copy editors and then they took apart a book and rewrote it and made it manageable. Or they, you know, they wrote setting and so they got relegated to fluff and so they didn't view themselves as contributors to the gaming industry. She's working on, or even they didn't get bylines because they were women and the men in the group took the bylines and they didn't fight tooth and nail. And so I think that everybody should be keeping an eye on Lillian's projects because she's doing something really profound and digging through the edges and the forgotten history of the gaming industry and really making sure that the contribution of women in this profound, transformative art form do not get lost.
I she's been a guest on Vodka O'Clock before, and we interact on Twitter, and she is just very easy to ask questions to. That's one thing, right off the bat. So if anybody wants to ask her, her opinion on either gender issues or just the something interesting about gaming, if you have any of those, she's really just the person to go to. Her Twitter is Lily or It, LILYORIT. And I know that she's also involved in this new type of sort of like a game. I don't know if it's a game or what it is, but that
Storium.
Storium. Yeah.
Like, I would describe it as a storytelling platform.
Okay. Because it's dynamic and it takes, you know, interaction and contributions with other people. So it's almost like just taking the campaign part of stories without having to worry about, you know, what your, you know, I guess, point system is.
Right. I am so excited. As a native multimedia storyteller who has run a multimedia campaign that has used text and face-to-face and tabletop, I'm so excited by the Storium model because it takes what people were doing natively with online role-playing and takes it up a level. And I'm super excited by it. And yeah, I actually backed Storium for two reasons. One, they were at Metatopia with us, and I was really excited by what I saw. And then Lillian's advocacy for it. I was like, you know what? If she's this excited, I need to get involved and I need to be on the ground floor.
That's so cool.
Let's wrap this up, Avi, with some key information from you. Where can people find you on the internet or find information about Double Exposure and buy their tickets and stuff?
So the website is dexposure.com. It's dexposure.com. You can follow links from the homepage. If for some reason any of our links are not working, try changing your browser. We discovered earlier this week that we're having a browser conflict with one update from, I think it's Firefox. So we are in Morristown, New Jersey from Wednesday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 6th. Please pre-register because then we know you're coming and you can sign up for games in advance. All of the instructions for doing that are on the website. If you have any questions or concerns, drop email to dexcon17@dexposure.com. We are tied to our email between now and the convention opening, so we will see it. We will respond. You can find me at Twitter at Avanelle, AVONELLE. And I am avanelle@dexposure.com if you have any questions and you want to get in touch with me for any follow-up. If you are a female game designer or a game designer from any disadvantaged populations and you want to get involved, you're a gamer of color, you are trans or gender fluid, and you want to come out to the convention, or you want to come out to Metatopia, drop me a line and we'll work something out.
Thank you so much, Abby. This has been such a pleasure.
It's my pleasure, Amber.
All right. I will be seeing you very soon in a couple of days. You guys, you can follow me at Elizabeth Amber on Twitter as well. Everything else is, of course, at amberunmasked.com. And I'll be bringing you some recaps of my time that the little bit of time that I get to spend at DexCon, because I will not be 24-hour gaming. I will be at my day job. So thanks, as always, for listening, everybody. Cheers.